Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 21st of September, 2017. Happy Equinox. Let's start with announcements from the California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team. They're going to be having a restoration this Saturday, September 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Wilder Ranch State Park. Thousands of years ago, California Indians moved into an area just north of Santa Cruz, hunting tule elk, bear, deer, and, on the shoreline, fur seals. The ancestral Ohlone people gathered and stayed in this area called Sand Hill Bluff. When Sand Hill Bluff is eventually open to the public, visitors will be able to visit the impressive and ancient archaeological site set aside by the Ohlone. We have been working at this special site for a few years now. Our focus this Saturday will be to continue the removal of invasive non-native ice plant on the coastal bluffs and assess what further work needs to be done. We hope to see you out there. That is this Saturday, September 23rd at 10 a.m. Just a special note, due to parking constraints and the number of folks anticipated at this project site, they will be meeting at Wilder Ranch State Park and carpooling to the site. Please arrive by 9:50 in the morning. They will plan on leaving and heading to the project site at 10 a.m. To get there, go north on Highway 1 and continue north to the turnoff on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch State Park. Watch for the sign indicating a left turn. Once you get to the kiosk, let the person there know you are volunteering and they will give you a parking pass. Meet the Habitat Restoration Team at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to eat, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. There might be a little fog early. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. For more information, contact their program leader, Linda. Her phone number is 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or you can email her at redwoodrn, that's R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at pacbell.net, or visit the website www.cruzcnps.org, C-R-U-Z-C-N-P-S.org. And in Poland's Białowieża Forest, logging and violence must come to an end. More activists are needed in this update from the Earth First Newswire from Save Białowieża. In our previous post, we already wrote that after the Luxembourg hearing of Polish Minister of the Environment, logging, violence, and activists, and the hurried selling of wood are continuing just as before. For example, on the 12th and 13th of September, the harvesters logged over 160-year-old spruces and some almost 200-year-old oaks in the section 228BA. Therefore, activists are still blocking the logging and machines wherever possible. They will not give up and will remain in the forest as long as necessary. What cannot be agreed upon is not only the logging itself, but also the arrogance, aggression, and violence of the forest guards supported by the police towards the activists. During yesterday's peaceful protest, activists were pulled out of the site. The situation got very violent. One of the activists was thrown to the ground, another one chained to a tree with metal wire. The guards were blocking the possibility of contacting the lawyers. They tried to stop recordings, and they refused to show their ID, which is obligatory. One of the activists was taken to the hospital. The forest guards had strangled him, put his face into the ground. The doctor stated he had a hematoma on the head and cuts on the neck. The situation is getting ridiculous. The minister is lying in Luxembourg. The guards are protecting illegal cutting, and the activists are still here with their human and citizens' rights being broken. The peaceful protests are being violently pacified. Amongst so many problems in the world, this one can get lost, but it cannot. Villa Luisa Forest is one of the most important nature sites in the world. Peaceful protests have to go on. We need more activists urgently to support the case and show solidarity. And 100 cops spend 11 hours evicting a tripod in Germany's Hambach Forest in this story from the Hambach Forest Defenders as found on the Earthworms Newswire. On September 19th at 8 o'clock in the morning, approximately 100 cops entered the millenarian Hambacher Forest, occupied for at least 6 years, blocking the expansion of RWE's open-cast lignite coal mine to remove the tripod, a live-in barricade. The official state line was that it was to keep the roads open for emergency vehicles in case an accident occurred in the forest. The emergency vehicles are the harvesters, bulldozers, and loaders of this year's cutting season, which will begin on October 25th, and the accident is the global climate chaos, millions of premature deaths a year, and irreplaceable habitat loss to which Hambacher, cynically named after the forest, is destroying mine. The single largest net carbon dioxide emitter in Europe is not an innocent bystander, but rather a culprit, extending its effects through the emission and pollution and through RWE global power conglomerate machines, impacting and destroying communities and the ecosystems from Colombia to England and to Germany and in Serbia. When the police entered the forest, they at first surrounded the tripod to prevent supporters joining in the two blockaders, one of whom was locked on the ground to a concrete lock-on, and the second, who was on the top of the tripod, which in its mid-level included a platform with a tent. Through a walkway from a neighboring tree, additional person was still able to join those on the inside. For the next 5 hours, the cops massed up around the barricade as large bulldozers removed the barricades leading into the heart of the forest. Each year, a 500-meter swath, which is cut to enlarge the mine, followed by backloaders loading the scrap metal and tarps, which comprises the leftover material from the occupation and performing a function of trash removal for the struggle. The barricade clearing was also immediately followed by peeps emerging from the forest and rebuilding the barricades behind the heavy equipment, often with the cops still in sight. During this time, the forest resonated with animal calls and music from approximately 40 forest defenders, as forest roads turned into parking lots for long lines of forces of repression. Paint and bottles of bitumen were thrown at the police vehicles. Pigs responded with snatch attacks at the people singing and playing drums in solidarity around the tripod. Altogether, 5 people were grabbed and then later released. By 1 o'clock, the cops began to cut the barbed wire connecting the wood stocked around the lower level of the tripod and got the forest activists locked on under the table of the tripod's kitchen. For over 2 hours, they went at it with their power tools, and as concrete cutting tools echoed in the forest, climbing cops started to get on to the tree with the walkway ropes, attempting to cut the lines and cut off the activist who descended into the tripod and was doing support to the people inside. Lower branches were being cut off and ladders attached to the tree, giving enough time to make it back across and into the crown of the tree, where the 2 climbing cops followed. Holding out for over an hour in the thin top branches of the 2 climbing tops a meter and a half below, attempting to convince the climber that they were just concerned about the person's safety and that the activist needed to be removed before proceeding to the tripod. Eventually, the cops gave up and descended from the tree to the tripod, where for over an hour they tugged, pulled, and then stepped on the tripod defender and later had a hard time removing him as he lay limp in the forks of the tripod. Once on the ground, Popo attempted to use pain compliance to try and get him to walk, but that did not work either, and he was then dragged and carried to a cop car. Overall, this has been one of the longest road barricade evictions, with over 9 hours of struggle, and when the cops left the forest, the barricade building and food sharing resumed in full. This year is an especially important time for the defense of the Hambacher Forest, as a new wave of deforestation is about to ensue during this winter's cutting season, and as another direct action Skillshare camp will take place in the forest from September 25th to October 1st. October 1st would have been the official start of this year's cutting season, but it has been postponed to October 25th as RWE is forced to appear in administrative court in Cologne by October 17th in a lawsuit initiated by Bund for Nature as a response to the company's lack of environmental assessment studies, its lack of the studies of costs of post-extraction cleanup, and last and definitely not least, two colonies of endangered bats being discovered in this year's cutting zone. And from New Mexico, we read that feds have killed a wolf that was preying on livestock. In this story by Rebecca Moss of the New Mexican, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently killed an endangered Mexican gray wolf, a rarely used tactic for managing an animal the federal government is charged with protecting. The Arizona Department of Game and Fish said in a monthly report issued Thursday that a female wolf, a member of the Diamond Pack in Arizona, was lethally removed last month following a series of confirmed livestock deaths. John Bradley, a spokesperson for the Fish and Wildlife Service, said the female wolf and her pack were responsible for 8 livestock deaths since January, a number he called excessive. Members of the White Mountain Apache tribe had also seen livestock killed by the pack and asked the federal government to remove the animals, Bradley said. Wolf advocates called the action extreme, saying it is the first time in a decade that the Fish and Wildlife Service has intentionally killed a Mexican wolf. But Bradley, in an email Friday, said there have been 3 intentional killings since 2010. The death of the Arizona wolf comes at a particularly uncertain time for the species in New Mexico and Arizona and its future management by the federal government. While the state of New Mexico has signed off on the new wolf recovery plan, advocates, including several state lawmakers, say it will do more to harm the animal's population than to ensure its future survival. At last count, there were just 113 in the wild in the 2 states. A female pup from the Diamond Pack was found dead in May and is under investigation, according to a Fish and Wildlife report. Bradley said the federal agency aims to take proactive measures to avoid conflicts between wolves and livestock, but these measures don't work in all situations. It is our intent to minimize the effects of Mexican wolves on livestock producers, Bradley said in an email. Trapping and killing the wolf from the Diamond Pack in Arizona allowed the agency to quickly respond to the conflict, he said. Interactions between wolves and livestock are commonplace and are at the core of an ongoing years-long debate about how the endangered wolves should be managed on federal lands. The debate largely falls along partisan lines, pitting conservationists against ranchers who say the predators cut into their livestock profits, and Republican Western states against the federal government and its interpretation of the Endangered Species Act. But wolf advocates say the Fish and Wildlife Service has taken a turn since January, aligning more strongly with ranching interests and state governments under the Trump administration than it did under President Barack Obama's leadership. It's sickening that the Trump administration is so heartless that it would gun down Mexican wolves on behalf of the livestock industry, Michael Robinson, a conservation advocate for the Center of Biological Diversity, said in a statement Thursday. He said the death of the Diamond Pack wolf was a step backward for Mexican wolf recovery. And in England, we read that the badger cull update from the Dorset Hunt SABS, as found in the Earth First Newswire. With North Camp up and running smoothly and a lovely base in the South Zone, we enter the second week of the cruel badger murder. The badger cull this year is covering pretty much all of Dorset and having people living throughout the country. We have paid the odd visit to some old hot spots in West Dorset. We can report things are going well throughout all 3 Dorset zones, and we are finding things in numerous locations and calling the pixies in to assist us. Sadly, we were too late for one poor badger, as you see in the enlarged photo on the left. This really shows how concerned everyone is with biosecurity. We have found some beautiful sets complete with latrines whilst patrolling across country, which are all safely plotted on a map. How can you help? If you live in Dorset, send us any details you have of sets you know about in Dorset in case we do not have them plotted. You can donate money because they have costs. If you have an odd old iPhone kicking around, we could put it to serious use, as long as it works. And if you see badgers on the side of the road anywhere in Dorset, please report them to the Hunt Sabs. Come and join us either set surveying or on a training walk or on a nightly patrol. We are a friendly group of people without egos or dramas who are getting the job done, and with more help, we could be more effective right across the country. And if you want to get in touch with them, it's DorsetHuntSab@riseup.net. That's DorsetHuntSab@riseup.net. And from the Revelator, we read that a Christmas Island bat, last seen in 2009, has been confirmed to be extinct. The news came in 8 years too late. This week, the IUCN announced that the Christmas Island pipistrelle bat has officially been declared extinct. This, sadly, was not exactly news to those who've been following the species. The author wrote about the pipistrelle bat three times in 2009, a critical year when conservationists struggled in vain to prevent the species' extinction. And here's what the author wrote in 2009. It's been a rough few years for this tiny Australian microbat, once fairly common in its home island. Populations have dropped dramatically in the last decade, first to 100 bats in 1994, then to 53 bats 3 years ago. Today, according to Lindy Lumsden, a research scientist at Australia's Department of Sustainability and Environment, there may be just 20 left. Lumsden now warns the Christmas Island pipistrelle may be extinct in as little as 6 months if the current rate of decline continued. At that time, Lumsden proposed collecting the last 20 bats from the wild and breeding them in captivity in order to prevent their extinction. That didn't happen. And as he wrote 3 months later in 2009, an attempt to capture and breed bats from similar species has so far failed. The bats have proven almost impossible to catch and even harder to keep alive. Just 2 bats were captured, but one has since died. At that time, experts worried the Christmas Island species had fallen to 4 individuals. Then in September, Lumsden's 6 month extinction prediction proved accurate, and all hope appeared to be lost. 8 scientists, along with volunteers from the Australasian Bat Society, spent the last 4 weeks on Christmas Island, but were unable to capture a single bat. Now, 8 years later, conservationists have finally given up on the Christmas Island pipistrelle. According to the species listed on the IUCN Red List, the last known bat of its kind disappeared on the 27th of August in 2009, and no individuals have been located since, despite extensive searching using proven techniques. So what caused this extinction? Well, no one knows for sure. Although there are a few clues, Christmas Island, an Australian territory in the Indian Ocean, faces numerous ecological problems which have affected both the bat and other native species and caused at least one other likely extinction. According to an IUCN press release, the pipistrelle's extinction may have been in combination of increased predation by introduced species, impacts of invasive yellow crazy ants on its habitat and on its invertebrate prey species, or another unknown cause. It's actually fairly rare to see extinction happen as visibly as with the Christmas Island pipistrelle. Perhaps its disappearance and now its confirmed extinction can serve as a warning to help protect other rare species before it becomes too late to save them. An emergency endangered species protection has been sought for Nevada's Dixie Valley toad. The Center for Biological Diversity has formally petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service seeking an emergency endangered species act protection for the Dixie Valley toad, a newly discovered toad species in central Nevada. The toad's survival is imminently threatened by a proposed geothermal energy project in its range. The Dixie Valley toad was only recently discovered to be a unique species, and it's already in grave danger, said Jenny Loda, a center attorney and scientist focused on protecting amphibians and reptiles. The only place on Earth the toad calls home is threatened by this deeply irresponsible geothermal project. The Dixie Valley toad is found in remote wetlands, fed by thermal desert springs on the western edge of the Dixie Valley Playa in Nevada's Churchill County. The toad's range is restricted to less than 1,500 acres, making it especially vulnerable to any impact on its habitat. Like many of Nevada's groundwater-dependent species, it relies on constant spring flows for survival. The beautiful little toad has large, prominent eyes. Its olive-covered body is dotted with black freckles and rust-colored warts bordered by black halos. The Bureau of Land Management is currently reviewing the proposed Dixie Meadows geothermal development project, which would harm the toad by constructing facilities and infrastructure on or near its habitat. The project would pump almost 46,000 acre-feet of water per year from the natural underground geothermal reservoir, altering groundwater flow patterns and potentially draining the toad's wetland habitat. "It's horrible to think we may lose this new toad just as we're beginning to learn about it," said Loda, "and protecting it under the Endangered Species Act is essential for the animal's survival." In addition to geothermal development in its range, threats to the Dixie Valley toad include disease, climate change, invasive species, and groundwater extraction. The Fish and Wildlife Service has 90 days to respond to the petition, and you can read more about it at the Center for Biological Diversity's website, www.biologicaldiversity.org. And from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, we read that CDFW has arrested four suspects for commercial sale of sport-harvested abalone. Wildlife officers have arrested four suspects on charges of harvesting abalone with a recreational fishing license and then selling it on the black market for profit, the California CDFW announced. The arrests were preceded by a five-month investigation of the suspects, some of whom had previously been convicted of similar violations. The group came to the attention of CDFW wildlife officers in November of 2016, when four associates were cited for multiple abalone violations at Moat Creek, a popular recreational abalone fishery in Mendocino County. One of them had previous abalone poaching convictions, and the wildlife officers suspected the group may be engaged in the commercial sale of recreational harvested abalone, which is unlawful. Beginning in May of 2017, wildlife officers observed a suspicious activity by the same group of suspects in several popular recreational abalone diving locations in both Mendocino and Sonoma counties. Further investigation revealed an extended group of people who were harvesting abalone and allegedly selling it on the black market. A five-month investigation uncovered evidence of various poaching crimes among the group, including unlawful sale of sport-caught abalone, take of abalone for personal profit, commercial possession of sport-caught abalone, exceeding the seasonal limit of abalone, and the falsification of abalone tags and conspiracy to commit the crime, among others. The collective efforts of these suspected poachers show a blatant disregard for the regulations designed to protect California's abalone resources, said David Bess, chief of CDFW's Law Enforcement Division. Whether it be California abalone or African ivory, wildlife officers will not tolerate trafficking of our wildlife species. And climate change is responsible for extinction of pikas in Lake Tahoe region, in this story by Abby Baronian of the Adventure Journal. A tiny high-pitched squeak from Otalis Field precedes the sighting. Look carefully, the pika's grayish-tan coat blends in well with the sun-soaked boulders. If you're lucky, you'll catch a glimpse of the diminutive, chubby, round-eared rabbit relative that lives in inhospitable environments. Of all possible mountain encounters, crossing paths with a pika is one of my favorites. Marmots are cute but aggressive and liable to chew through tents, trekking poles, and other necessities. Mountain goats killed a guy in my favorite national park. Bears are cool from a distance but stress-inducing up close. And bear hangs are a pain in the butt. Moose and mountain lions don't have your best interests at heart. Elk and deer are everywhere, and they will kick you. Giant birds of prey are awesome, but so far away. Pikas strike the right balance, adorable and totally non-threatening. More importantly, the American pika is part of a crucial part of its local food chain. In Lake Tahoe, for instance, they're important prey for owls, hawks, coyotes, and weasels, which makes their disappearance from the area concerning. According to a recently published study conducted by the North Lake Tahoe area, pikas have disappeared from their long-held homes in the scree fields of the Sierra Nevada. Since 1910, the Lake Tahoe area has seen a 1.9 degree C rise in local temperature, that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit, and a significant decline in snowpack, dramatically shrinking the pika habitat. Biologist Joseph Stewart spent the last 6 years studying the impact of these changes on local climate on pika species. Specifically, he and a small team painstakingly scoured a 65-square-mile area over those 6 years and found plenty of past evidence of pika habitation, but not a single living pika. Pikas are typically easy for researchers to find. They're loud and leave behind obvious traces. To identify sites of past habitation, researchers carbon date pika poop, among other techniques. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock as part of our Environment Friday programming. Or you could listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 a.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., or WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, if they're on the air at the moment, Sundays at noon. And you can tune to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill in Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, or KPHD in 93.3 in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation 104.1 in Berkeley, California. All these stations broadcast the Earth First Update. Check their webpage for day and time. Or you could listen online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio stream, gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Or you could listen anytime at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous version of the Earth First Update. And please, would you ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week? It's free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening. And please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.